Dear students of my course, this is part 6 of the Network Science course. Please open PhD SEM 6 PowerPoint file, and you will see the title slide, which is Network and Stability, part 6, Examples for Networks. This is the continuation of the examples for networks which we started in the last lecture by listing you the protein structure networks and giving you an overview about the cellular networks. Now, the first cellular network, which I mentioned you in the last slide of the previous lecture, or the last segment of the previous lecture, were protein-protein interaction networks. And there are several organisms where protein-protein interaction networks are well defined, and the number of these organisms is growing continuously, day by day, actually. We have a large information about yeast, about the C. elegans, which is the worm, a small worm, the fruit fly, the drosophila, protein-protein interaction network, and recently we have an increasing amount of information about the human protein-protein interaction network, which is very much important, obviously, for drug development and drug design reasons. This network is also a small word network, which means that the proteins, which are the nodes of this network, are connected with relatively few edges, which are physical interactions between two neighboring proteins in this network. So you may reach actually any protein, starting from any other protein in the cellular protein-protein interaction network, with only a few steps. The degree distribution of this network is scale-free. This means that there are hubs in the protein-protein interaction network. So proteins which have neighbors, like 100 neighbors or 200 neighbors or even more neighbors. Now you may ask here the question: how come that here a physical structure of a single protein may occupy the neighborhood of 100 other proteins? How do these fit, these proteins, into that relatively small space, which is the area around this particular protein? Now, the first answer to this question is that proteins are not are having protrusions, so they are not globular in the sense of a billiard ball or a ball, so they are not rounded completely, but they have protrusions here and there, and therefore their surface is much larger, or may become much larger, and these protrusions, these small lobes of the proteins which are protruding from the globular structure of the protein, are usually binding sites for other proteins. So this is the reason why more proteins can surround a single protein than you would expect. We as human beings are relatively globular. I mean, we have four protrusions only: our arms and our legs, maybe our head, if you are thinking about it like that. But these are relatively short, and therefore, if you would like to attach physically to yourself a large amount of people, then you may use them only at a limited way. Now, the most important part of this game or part of this story is that actually proteins may change their neighbors, and most of them do change their neighbors continuously. So this is why they are becoming hubs, because they are not continuously having that or those neighbors, all of them, around them. So most proteins are actually not party hubs, but behave as date hubs in a certain extent. So they are changing their neighborhood time to time by, for example, translocation from one subcellular compartment to another, or by phosphorylation and therefore changing their binding partners, or by many other means. The definition of protein-protein interaction networks on the next slide, as I was telling you before, that the nodes are proteins, the edges are physical interactions, and these are probability interactions, probability networks. This is very important. So if In the protein-protein interaction network, there are two proteins which are neighboring, which are the neighbors of each other. Then they are not; they should not be visualized or thought about like a protein A on the bottom of a certain cell and the protein B, which is physically attached to protein A at that very bottom of a certain cell. Not. These attachments or these edges are actually probabilities. So this means that if you are examining a large amount of proteins, which you usually do when you are doing a biochemical experiment, when you first destroy the cellular structure, and then you are experimenting biochemically, what type of interactions can you find in a protein-protein interaction between a certain protein and other proteins? So if you are doing such a biochemical experiment, you lose the cellular structure. Therefore, we are only talking about probabilities in this case. What is the probability that in an average human cell, let's say healthy cell, or in a different network, in a diseased cell, in a cell from a diabetic patient, two proteins are interacting with each other? And obviously, if you have a healthy cell and if you have a diseased cell, a cell from a disease, from a patient suffering from a disease, then you have a different protein-protein interaction network. And actually, in our group, we have some very interesting research going on comparing cancerous cells and normal cells, or cancerous, precancerous, and normal cells, their protein-protein interaction networks. Actually, if you have a different cell, so you have a fibroblast, for example, or a liver cell, or a hepatocyte, then you have a different protein interaction network. If you have a young cell, a cell from a young person, and a cell from an old person, then you have again a different protein interaction network, especially if you are taking into account the weights, so the probabilities of the interactions, and not only the one or zero statement that is it probable after a certain extent or beyond a certain limit that these proteins are interacting, or is it not probable. So this is the non-weighted network, that if it's probable, there is an edge. If it's non-probable, there is no edge. However, most of these networks, protein-protein interaction networks, are weighted. Which means that there is a probability, there is a weight between or there is a weight associated with the edge, which is meaning the probability of the interaction. Now, next slide shows you the main databases of protein-protein interactions. There are many, actually, and these are freely available, so you can actually browse them and carefully analyze them and download them. And the best data, as I told you, are from yeast, C. elegans, Drosophila, fruit fly, and humans. For example, the string database, with which about which you have the website here, is having a mixed data, and you have to be very careful about this. There are genetic interactions, which means that if one gene is overexpressed, which are the other genes which are consequently overexpressed together with it? It is not really a protein-protein interaction, because you cannot really say that the two genes are physically overacting with each other if they are interacting with each other in the signaling mechanism. So this is only an indirect interaction. Now, there are data about high throughput experiments, which means that you are measuring thousands of different interactions at the same time. Obviously, high throughput experiments are giving you a large amount of data, but these data are not precise enough, so you have to discriminate them from actual biochemical experiments which are pointing out certain interactions, and they are proving that particular interactions very well. Now, There are co-expression data, as I mentioned you before, and there are text mining data. Text mining data means that that, for example, in very early age, that is a very simple example. Text mining data meant at the time, 20 years ago or 15 years ago, that the names of two proteins is appearing or are appearing in the same abstract of the same paper, and they were rationalizing it that if the two proteins are appearing in the same paper in the abstract, their names, then these two proteins are interacting in some way. Obviously, this is completely nonsense, because if the abstract was writing that this protein A is not interacting with protein B, that this very simple analysis would detect this interaction as positive, but it is actually negative. Obviously, recently, text mining means very carefully designed methodologies which are taking into account the actual meaning of these texts. These are very carefully designed now and can give you, well, quite good enough data. But obviously there is always a chance of mistakes because some people do not know English that well, like myself, and they are writing a different the interaction in a different way, which the regular text mining methodology will not understand or will not recognize as an interaction. And therefore, that interaction will be missing from this data. So there are many pitfalls and drawbacks of this text mining. So actually, you have to concentrate on experimental data in these databases, which are coming from direct experiments and not high throughput experiments. Now, the BioGrid database, which is in the bottom, is containing this type of data only. This is curated data from the literature, so obviously this has much fewer amount of data than the string database. This is quite obvious. But those data which are in the BioGrid database, those are very, very reliable data, so you may not have to think about whether these are experimental, whether these are text mining or genetic interaction or ice throughput or whatever. So those are carefully curated, that's how we call it. So they were cross-checked by persons, by scientists, and verified by scientists. Now, in the next slide, I'm giving you a short introduction or some flavors of the main methodologies to identify protein-protein interactions. And the first method I am showing you is the yeast-2 hybrid system. Now, this yeast-2 hybrid system is using actually a bait and the prey, so two proteins actually. One of them is your protein, which you are interested in, that I would like to know the neighbors of this particular protein. And what you do in this particular methodology, you build genetically by molecular biological methods a chimera, a complex, an attachment of your protein, which is protein A, let's call it protein A, your protein, which you are interested in, and half of a transcription factor. Now, this sounds interesting. Why only the half of the transcription factor? Because obviously the half of the transcription factor is not active by itself. It requires the other half of the transcription factor. However, the other half of the transcription factor is not built, constructed genetically or molecular biologically to the gene of your protein, protein A, to which you are interested in, but to a whole protein library, or a whole library of genes encoding proteins. So the other half of your transcription factor is connected by thousand proteins, let's say, or several thousands of proteins at the same time, each of them. And then you are expressing your own protein, protein A, with one half of your transcription factor, which is a yeast transcription factor, together with the library, thousands of other proteins which have the other half of the transcription factor. Now, what will happen? If your protein A is neighbor, is neighboring, is making a complex, an association with one of these thousands of proteins which are containing the other half of the transcription factor, then the transcription factor, the two halves of the transcription factor, are coming together in a physical distance, in a short distance. So they might act together. So they might act as an active transcription factor in spite of being two halves, so cut into two halves. Now, you may detect this, because if you have a whole transcription factor, then this transcription factor will bind to the DNA sequence, and the DNA sequence will be activated, and transcription is going on, and you may make a construct which is making a protein which can be visualized because it is emitting light, or because it's fluorescently active, or because it is active in any other ways. There are many ways of that, practically to doing it, but each of them is using this technique that there is one half of the transcription factor and the other half of the transcription factor, and these are built or bound together by binding of the two proteins which were engineered molecular biologically together with the one half of the transcription factor and the other half of the transcription factor. So in this way, indirectly, you may have a list of the interactors. Technically, it's done that this whole library of proteins containing the other half of the transcription factor is spread. Only one of them is expressed in one yeast organism at a given time, and obviously there are billions of yeast organisms around, and they are expressing the thousands of these proteins as a library. Each of them is expressing only one, but there are billions of them, so they might express the thousands of these proteins, and you are examining those yeast organisms, which are showing that reporter gene, which was activated by this transcription factor, which had one half of your protein A, the other half in the thousands of the other proteins. Now, if this gene was activated by the transcription factor in a particular yeast organism, that means that your protein A had found a neighbor in that particular yeast organism. Now, the only task what you have to do after that to sequence that particular gene which was expressed in this yeast organism from the thousands of potential neighboring proteins, and then you found neighbor one of your protein A. And you have several of these data because you sequence many of the yeast organisms here, growing them as clones, as identical organisms as compared to each other, and therefore finally you have a long list of partnering proteins. Each of them has partner your protein A, which is the protein you are curious about, as one of the partners, and some other proteins, protein B or protein F or protein P or Q or whatever, as the other partner. And obviously there are some proteins, there will be several proteins which are reoccurring in this whole list or long list, and those the number of occurrences of the proteins is actually the probability of the interaction. If you will find your particular protein A partnering with protein B very often, that there is a large probability that they are really partners or neighbors in the protein-protein interaction of the yeast organism. If you will find protein F like seldom only in your experiments, there is a little probability, and you can actually give a numerical data because of these occurrences as a probability of the interaction. Now, this methodology is very good and very useful, and it is automatized by now, so you can actually order it as a kit. It's not very cheap, but if you have money enough, then you just order it, and there might be even robots who are making these experiments, so you may order the robot if you have even more money, and then you will have your data as a printout of the robot. So this is fairly much automatized by now, and therefore we have much of data flooding us from this type of experimentation. So finally, you have a list of proteins, and that is constructing your network. Now, the background, the drawback, the bad part of this methodology is that each of these protein pairs have to make a valid interaction in two halves of the transcription factor. Now, this transcription factor, as I told you, is active in transcribing a gene. Ho-ho! Where does this happen? Transcription of genes does happen in the nucleus only. And therefore, this methodology is biased towards nuclear proteins. If a protein is all the time in the plasma membrane, for example, and it never appears in the cell nucleus, then if you express this protein, it will remain at the plasma membrane of the yeast organism. And the half of your transcription factor will be always with this protein at the plasma membrane. It will never go to the nucleus. Therefore, it cannot act as an active transcription factor, because it has to be then in the nucleus. So this methodology is very good, but this is very much biased towards proteins which can occur or can be transported to the cell nucleus. Which is bad. I mean, therefore, this methodology has limitations. Now, the next slide shows you another methodology, which we call co-complex methodology. This is actually using affinity purification and mass spectrometry, and this is actually giving you the same type of data at the end, but with different methods. Your protein is here, the protein which is represented by a red dot. There are some other proteins which are represented by colored lines, which are binding to this protein, and some other proteins which are represented by gray lines, which are not binding to this protein. Now, what do you do? You are associating your own protein to a macroscopic bead. This gray ellipsoid in the middle of the figure is a macroscopic bead. So the size of the protein, the red dot, and the size of this gray elliptic figure or part of the figure is not equal. It is equal just to make the drawing correct, or just to make the drawing visible. But in practice, the ellipsis, that gray segment, is huge, is as huge as a building, if the size of your protein is the red dot. So it is macroscopic. Your protein is microscopic. So with the macroscopic bead, you can actually fish out your protein from the soup of proteins which were originally there, and together with your own protein, which is the red dot, you are fishing out these binding proteins, which is the blue, the magenta, the green, and the orange or brownish protein, which are binding to your own protein. And then what you do, you wash out from this complex attached to this macroscopic bead the residual amount of proteins, which are the grayish proteins, which did not bind to your particular protein. And then, finally, you analyze your protein and the neighboring protein by mass spectrometry. Mass spectrometry bombards or tears into parts these proteins and see and gives the correct mass of the parts, and from the correct mass of the parts by a sophisticated computerized methodology, you can actually conclude to the amino acid sequence, and from the amino acid sequences by comparing them you can conclude to the binding partners. So finally you will have a list of binding partners. Now this is very superb, and this is not biased to nuclear proteins, so this is actually very good to any other proteins, but there is a trick here as well. I was telling you that you are washing out the proteins, the grayish proteins, which are not binding to your protein. Okay, but how do you wash them out? By a buffer, or by some detergents which are removing more proteins, or by a buffer, some ions which are removing some other proteins and the detergent, or you add more detergent, or you are adding more than one detergent, so many detergents at the same time. You now can understand that there are different levels of washes, and different levels of wash procedures are removing different amounts of non-binding proteins. If you wash your red protein, which is covalently attached to this bead, or which is attached very firmly to this bead, very, very well, or very thoroughly, then you will wash out all the binding proteins, even the blue one, the magenta one, the green one, and the yellow one, and you will get back only your own protein, which is zero, which is not an experiment, which is not a data. So you have to select your washing procedure here very carefully. And if you select it to be a very gentle washing procedure, then you will have many, many neighbors of your protein. But obviously, this will not be the direct neighbors of your protein, but this might be the neighbors of the blue protein, which is binding to your protein. So you might fish out a whole complex of associated with your protein. Well, that might not be bad, but this is not direct association. So this is already not correct enough data. And if you start to wash your complex more carefully, then you will have less and less proteins attached. Now, where to end this procedure? Where to say that this wash was careful enough? At the very beginning or at the very end? You don't know. So this is the trick in this particular case, that the washing procedure has to be selected very carefully, and therefore this experimentation is also relatively complex besides being simple. Now the main methods to identify protein-protein interaction, slide 3, is giving you some additional methodology, like what I mentioned to you, genetic interactions, which may be indirect, co-expression data, which may be also indirect, text mining, which can be accurate, but it is also not a direct type of data. Now, next slide shows you the assessment of protein-protein interaction data. You have your results, which is in the middle. You have your gold standard, which is on the left side, and it is yellow gold. The gold standard are protein-protein interactions which you are knowing for sure that they must exist, because everyone has been detecting them before. So it is part of human knowledge now that they must associate with each other. So this is your gold standard. But there are true negatives, as the red circle on the right side of the figure. These true negatives are protein-protein interactions which must not present. How come? What is an example of this? For example, one of your proteins is continuously in the cell nucleus. The other protein is continuously at the plasma membrane or in the cytosol. It never appears in the nucleus. These two proteins must not bind to each other. If you find them as partners, that is an artifact. So actually your results are overlapping with the gold standard. This we call coverage, and they are overlapping with the true negatives. This we call false positives. So the coverage should be high and the false positives should be low. So this is actually giving you a general kind of methodology to design a scientific experiment. Because in a scientific experiment, you always have to have a positive control, which is your gold standard, and a negative control, which is the true negative. And you have to experiment all the three, your own result, the positive control, and the negative control. And usually people are not thinking about controls well enough. And they are particularly bad in designing negative controls. So think about this. If you ever do a scientific experiment, you have to design a positive control and a negative control at the same time, together with your data, your results, because otherwise you will not understand your own data. Obviously, the next slide shows you that the low confidence, so the low probability interactions may not mean that this interaction is not happening in reality. This may mean that this reaction is happening, but it has a low affinity. Now, this is very difficult to discriminate, and this is actually giving you, or giving us scientists, the truly difficult part of this experimentation. How to deal with the low affinity interactions. As I mentioned to you in the beginning of these lectures, that low affinity interactions are usually far distancing interactions in the networks, and they are building distant regions of the networks. So they are very important for the novel responses of the networks. So if you are missing these low affinity interactions, then you are missing a lot. But to identify them, that is not very easy by the scientific methodologies. Now, in the next slide, I'm showing you that evolution develops more resilient interactomes as we are coming from very simple organisms to very sophisticated organisms like ourselves, Homo sapiens. And resilience means that the interactome, the giant component of the interactome, is becoming intact after damage. This is a very interesting result, and this gives us confidence that our interactome is very well designed by this evolutionary process. And the next slide shows you a flavor of metabolic networks. As I mentioned to you, metabolic networks are having a different definition. Here the nodes are metabolites and the edges are enzymes, proteins, between the metabolites, converting one metabolite to another. Now, you may actually understand, or you may actually figure out, that this network is a kind of inverse than the previous network was, because in the previous network, in the protein-protein interaction network, the nodes were the proteins and the edges were physical interactions. Here the edges are the proteins and the nodes are the metabolites, either the starting the substrate or the product of the particular enzymatic reaction. So what is actually interesting that this network is relatively a small word network. We accept some of the metabolic pathways which are protruding from the network, and it is more or less a scale-free network. So there are hubs in this network, but there are question marks, as you can see on the figure, because, for example, hubs can be molecules like water. Now, do you consider water really a very specific molecule? Not. Or ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It is participating in hundreds of reactions, obviously, because it is giving the energy of that particular enzymatic reaction. But it is not the substrate of the protein, but it is a cofactor. So you may not identify it as a substrate or as a part of this network, or even water. And therefore, the most important hubs can be deleted from this network. So whether it's a scale-free network or not, that's questionable. The lethality of the particular node or contact or edge depends on the reaction. Obviously, those enzymatic reactions which are very important, which are part of the glycolytic pathway or the citric acid cycle or lipid synthesis or others, those are very important. So if you delete them, then most of the time they are lethal. However, there are some exceptional mechanisms which are also lethal if you delete them, and we are calling them choking enzymes or choking reactions in this metabolic network, because they are encoding an enzymatic reaction which is producing a molecule which is very specific to that particular organism. Therefore, it is not in the middle of this metabolic network, but it is on the side. But without which without that molecule, this particular organism cannot be viable, because maybe it is a part, is a key component of its membrane, or it's a key component of its signaling mechanism, or it's important for this brain function, or whatever. And therefore, there are several reactions which are not in the middle of such a metabolic network, but these are also lethal if you delete them. So there are some surprises in this metabolic network methodology. Now, the next network which I am showing to you is gene transcription network. Here the nodes are genes, and the links, the edges, are transcription factors. Now, I would like to point out that if you are coming from a relatively simple organism like the yeast, which is a unicellular organism, to a multicellular organism, which is C. elegans, and to a complex organism like ourselves, humans, then you are having an increasing amount of transcription factor as a percentage of the whole genome. From 4% it is increased to 8%, so it is increased to double as much. Now, this is important. What is actually giving us complexity, it is not the parts of the network, so the different functions of the network, but the regulation of these different functions of the network. So usually protein functions, enzymatic functions, or other protein functions are pretty well defined in a long range, or in a long range of organisms, in a long range of evolution. There is nothing new concerning biochemical mechanisms. The same type of glycolytic pathways operated in a very primitive organism than in humans. So there is no space for invention here. A very efficient pathway has been invented very early on in evolution, and it was frozen. It was just used later on in the evolution. What has been invented later on is the regulation. So humans are actually different because of their regulation, and not because of their usual functions in biochemical meaning in their cells. Now, the next type of network I'm showing to you is the signal transduction networks. Here we are comparing three networks. In the top panels, there are the C. elegans signal transduction networks. In the middle panels, there is the Drosophila signal transduction network, and in the bottom, there is the human. Now, the nodes of these networks are the major signaling pathways, like the TGF pathways, the IGF-1 pathway, the NOTCH pathway, the VNT pathway, and so on and so on. And you can see that only a few pathways are active in C. elegans. Quite many pathways, almost each of them, are active in Drosophila, and each of them are active in human. But not this, what is the major difference between C. elegans and humans, but the number of crosstalks. In C. elegans, there are only a few crosstalks between the various pathways. In Drosophila, there are many more. In humans, there are all crosstalks which are possible amongst the pathways. Now, you may ask a question here, that what is then the complexity in this network? This is a full graph. It is the same in each cells. So why do our cells in human organisms are different? What is the difference between a neuron and a fibroblast, or a neuron or a hepatocyte in a human organism? And the answer is not obvious, because the answer is that not each of the pathways is expressed, or not each of the crosstalks is expressed the same way in the different types of cells of the human body. And this is actually what is making a difference between a hepatocyte and a neuronal cell and a fibroblast or other cells in the human body as a signaling mechanism. If you are just thinking about it, then you may observe that this is a very important feature of our body, because this is actually limiting the number of cells, the types of cells what we do have in our body. Very interestingly, we have approximately 200 types of cells in our body, like keratinocytes or red blood cells or white blood cells or the cells what I have listed before. And additionally, we have at least 2000 types of neurons in our brain. Now, this gives you an idea of human evolution. Altogether, our whole body can be composed from 200 types of cells. These are 200 types of tissues in our body. Now, our brain is composed minimum 2000 types of brain cells. So this is giving an additional layer of evolution, and this is giving you the understanding why human thinking is so much more developed than any other thinking what we know about, except maybe dolphins or some others. So this is actually giving you the understanding of complexity from the signaling point of view. Neuronal cells have many more refined signaling pathways, or many more refined crosstalks between signaling pathways, and that's how they can actually build up a very sophisticated mechanism of their function. And in addition, they have a very sophisticated structure. And together, the structure and the function are giving us a very sophisticated output in terms of neurons. Now, this was the end of this lecture. Thank you very much for your listening, and see you at the next lecture of this network science course.